Mindhunter, Cassette 6.
Tholt looked like a stronger choice to me. He fit virtually all of the profile elements. His parents had separated when he was young. His mother was a domineering woman, overly involved in her son's life. At 26, he was inept with women. He told police he had had just 2 sexual encounters in his life, both with an older woman who made fun of him because he couldn't get it up. He said he and Betty Jane were very much in love and engaged to be married, though she dated and had sexual relationships with other men. I felt sure that if she were still alive, she'd tell a completely different story. At her funeral, he said he wanted to dig up the coffin and climb in there with her. And when interviewed by the police, he'd cried incessantly over the loss of Betty Jane. Butch Tholt and his brother Mike worked as trash haulers, the police said. Jesus, this sounds pretty good, I replied. They had access to the dump site, reason to know about it and go there, and a means of transporting the body. But as much as I liked Butch as a suspect, 2 things bothered me. First, as I'd expected, he was kind of a little twerp who wasn't much bigger than Shade. I didn't think he was capable of moving the body or arranging it into the frog-like position with the legs spread and bent at the knees in which it was found. Second, semen was found in the victim's vagina, indicative of a traditional rape. I wouldn't have been surprised to find semen on the body, in her underpants or other clothing, but not like this. Like David Berkowitz, this guy would be a masturbator, not a rapist. He had to get his sexual satisfaction indirectly. It didn't add up. This was a mixed, organized, disorganized presentation, in many ways similar to the murder of Francine Elvison in New York, with the same early blitz attack, facial disfigurement, and genital mutilation. Whereas Elvison's nipples had been cut off, Shade's entire breasts had been removed. But in the New York case, the larger Carmine Calabro had carried the tiny victim a couple of floors up and left her, and the ejaculation had all been masturbatory. Keeping the lessons from Odom and Lawson in mind, I thought there was only one logical possibility. I believed it was likely Butch Tholt had met Betty Jane on the street after she left her job. They got into an argument. He beat her up and probably rendered her unconscious, then transported her to a secluded location. I also believed he could have struck the blow that killed her, cut off her hair, mutilated her body, and kept the breasts as souvenirs. But between the time she was first attacked and the time she was killed, she'd been raped, and I didn't think a disorganized, sexually inadequate, mother-dominated young man such as Tholt was capable of that. And I didn't think he'd move the body by himself. Butch's brother Mike was the logical second suspect. He came from the same background and had the same job. He'd spent some time in a mental institution and had a record of violence, behavior problems, and poor anger control. The main difference was he was married, though their mother was so domineering in his life as well. The night Betty Jane Shade was abducted, Mike's wife had been in the hospital having a baby. Her pregnancy was a major stressor, plus it had deprived him of a sexual release. It made perfect sense that after the attack, the panicked Butch had called his brother, who had raped the young woman while Butch looked on, then, after the murder, had helped him dispose of the body. I told the police an indirect, non-threatening approach would be best. Unfortunately, they'd already interviewed Butch several times and polygraphed him. As I knew it would, the exam showed no deceit on his part, but inappropriate emotional reactions. I thought the best approach now would be to focus on Mike, hammering home that all he did was have sex with Shade and help dispose of her body, but that if he didn't cooperate at this point, he would be in as much hot water as his brother. This tactic paid off. Both brothers and their sister, Kathy Wiesinger, who claimed to be Betty Jane's best friend, were arrested. Kathy, according to Mike, had been in on the body disposal as well. So what happened? I believe Butch had been trying to have sex with this sexually attractive, sexually experienced woman, but couldn't. His resentment built up until it didn't take much to set him off. After he attacked Shade, he panicked and called in his brother. But his anger built even further when Mike could have sex with her and he couldn't. His anger continued, and 4 days later he mutilated the body, giving him the final word. One of the victim's breasts was recovered. Mike told police that Butch kept the other one, which didn't surprise me. Wherever he hid it, it was never found. Charles Butch Soult was convicted of first-degree murder, and Mike, following a plea arrangement, was sent to a mental institution. Chief Reeder commented publicly that we were directly instrumental in developing the investigation and obtaining statements from the perpetrators. We, in turn, were fortunate to have a local partner like him who had been trained in our methods and understood the collaborative process between police and Quantico. Because of this cooperation, we were able to take out a killer and his accomplice before they had a chance to kill again. Chief Reeder and his men and women went back to the business of keeping the peace in Logan Township, Pennsylvania, and I went back to my 150-odd other active cases, hoping I'd learn something that would help me in at least one of them to walk in the shoes of both perpetrator and victim. Chapter 10. Everybody Has a Rock. One evening years before, when I was back home after my ill-fated college experience in Montana, I was having dinner with my parents at a pizza and beer place in Uniondale, Long Island, called Coldstream. Just as I took a bite out of my slice of everything with extra cheese, my mother, out of the blue, said, "John, have you ever had sexual relations with a woman?" I swallow hard, trying to gulp down what I had just bitten off. This isn't the kind of question 19 or 20-year-old kids are used to being asked by their mothers in the mid-1960s. I turned to my father for some sign of support, but he's stone-faced. He'd been caught as much off guard as I had. "Well, have you?" she persists. She wasn't a Holmes for nothing. Yeah, Mum, I have." I see this look of revulsion come over my mother's face. "Well, who was she?" she demands. Well... I've sort of lost the healthy appetite I'd come into the place with. "Actually, there have been several." I don't tell her one had been in her mid-teens in a home for unwed mothers in Bozeman. But you'd have thought I just told her where I'd hidden the bodies after I'd dismembered them, and it had been right in their basement. "Who is going to have you as a husband now?" she laments. Again, I turn to my unusually silent father. "Come on, Dad, help me out." "Oh, I don't know, Dolores. It's not a big deal these days." "It's always been a big deal, Jack," she counters, then turns back to me. "What would happen, John, if your future bride someday asked you whether you had had relations with another woman before you met her?" I pause in mid-bite. "Well, Mom, I would tell her the truth." "No, don't say that," my father pipes up. "What do you mean, Jack?" my mother asks. "Okay, Dad, let's see you get out of this one." The interrogation session ended in an uneasy stalemate. I'm not sure if I got anything out of the encounter. I either told Pam of my past, or she suspected it. At any rate, she did agree to marry me, despite my mother's fears. But when I thought back to that grilling from my perspective as a federal law enforcement official, profiler, and expert on criminal behavior and psychology, an important realization did dawn on me. Even if I'd had all the training and analytical experience that I have now, I still wouldn't have handled my mother's inquisition any better. Because she'd gotten to me on a vulnerable point of truth. I'll give you another example. Ever since I became the FBI's chief profiler, I personally selected and trained all all of the other profilers. For that reason, I've enjoyed a particularly close and cooperative relationship with all the men and women who've been on my team. Most of them have become stars in their own right. But if I could ever be said to have had a true disciple among them, it would be Greg Cooper. Greg left a prestigious job as chief of police in a town in Utah while still in his early 30s and joined the FBI after hearing Ken Lanning and Bill Hagemeyer speak at a law enforcement seminar. He distinguished himself in the Seattle field office, but always had the dream of coming to Quantico to work in behavioral science. He'd requested and studied all of my profiling and analysis of the Green River Killer. And when I flew out to Seattle to appear on a viewer participation television special called Manhunt Live, Greg volunteered to be my chauffeur and guide. When I became chief of the reorganized investigative support unit, Greg was working in an FBI resident agency in Orange County, California, and living in Laguna Niguel. I brought him back to Quantico, where he became an outstanding performer. When he first came into the unit, Greg was assigned to share an underground, windowless office with Jana Monroe, a former police officer and homicide detective in California, before she became a special agent, who, among her many other fine qualities, happens to be a smashingly attractive blonde. In other words, she puts it all together. Now, not too many men would find this a hardship assignment, but Greg happens to be a devout Mormon, a very straight and devoted family man with five lovely children and a stunning wife named Rhonda, to whom it was a major sacrifice to move from their sunny California paradise to sleepy, hot, and humid Virginia. Every time she asked about his office mate, Greg would hem and haw and try to change the subject. Finally, about 6 months after he'd been on the job for us, Greg brings Rhonda to the unit Christmas party. I'm not there because I'm working a case out of town, but the naturally vivacious Jana is. And typical for her in a party situation, she's wearing a subtle, understated, short, and form-fitting bright red dress with a plunging neckline. When I get back, Jim Wright, the unit's second-in-command, who's taken over for me as profiling program manager, tells me there were real fireworks between Rhonda and Greg after the party. She's none too happy about his spending his days in such close confines with a beautiful, tough, charming agent who knows her way around a firing range and dance floor with equal facility. So I have my secretary get Greg out of a meeting and tell him I want to see him right away. He gets to my office looking somewhat concerned. He's only been here 6 months. This unit has been his dream, and he really wants to make good. I look up from my desk and say, "Close the door, Greg. Sit down." He does, even more disturbed by my tone of voice. "I just got off the phone with Rhonda," I continue. "I understand you've had some problems." "You just got off the phone with Rhonda?" He's not even looking at me. He's staring straight at the call director phone on my desk. "Look, Greg," I said in my most soothing counselor tones, "I'd like to cover for you, but when you and Jana go on the road together, I can't make any special provisions. This is something you're going to have to deal with on your own. Rhonda obviously knows what's going on between you and Jana, and..." "Nothing's going on between me and Jana," he splutters. "I know there are a lot of stresses in this job, but you've got a beautiful, terrific wife, nice kids. Don't throw it all away." "It's not what you think, John. It's not what she thinks. You have to believe me." And all the time, he's still staring at that telephone, maybe thinking if he concentrates hard enough, he's going to be able to burn it right through the desk. He's broken out in a cold sweat. I can see the carotid artery pounding in his neck. He's heading south fast. So at that point, I let up. "Look at you, you miserable wretch," I grin triumphantly. "You call yourself an interrogator?" At the time, he was preparing a chapter on interrogation for the Crime Classification Manual. "Have you done anything to be guilty about? No, John, I swear. And look, you're putty in my hands. You're completely innocent. You're a former chief of police. You're an experienced interrogator. And yet I was able to play you like a yo-yo. So what do you have to say for yourself? At that particular time, as the sweat of relief rolled off his balding head, he didn't have anything to say for himself, but he got the point. I knew I could jerk him around like that because it had been done to me with equal success and could be again if the situation arose. We're all vulnerable. It doesn't matter how much you know, how experienced you are, how many suspect interrogations you've handled successfully. It doesn't matter if you understand the technique. Each of us can be gotten to if you can just figure out where and how we're vulnerable. I'd learned this during one of my earliest cases as a profiler, and I put it to use many times thereafter, not only in demonstrations to my own team. It was the first time I actually staged an interrogation. In December 1979, Special Agent Robert Leary from the Rome, Georgia Resident Agency called with the details of a particularly horrible case and asked me to give it my top priority. The week before, Mary Frances Stoner, a pretty and outgoing 12-year-old girl in Adairsville, about a half hour from Rome, had disappeared after being dropped off by the school bus at the driveway to her house, approximately 100 yards back from the road. Her body was later found about 10 miles away in a wooded Lover's Lane area by a young couple who noticed the bright yellow coat over her head. They contacted police and didn't disturb the scene, a critical consideration. The cause of death was determined to be blunt force trauma to the head. Post-mortem examination detected skull fracturing consistent with a large rock. There's a blood-stained one right near her head in the crime scene photos. Marks on the neck also indicated manual strangulation from the rear. Before I looked at the case materials, I wanted to know as much as possible about the victim. No one had anything other than wonderful things to say about Mary Frances. She was described as friendly to everyone, gregarious and charming. She was sweet and innocent, a drum majorette in the school band who often wore her uniform to school. She was a cute 12-year-old who looked 12 rather than trying to look 18. She wasn't promiscuous. She'd never been involved with drugs or alcohol. The autopsy clearly indicated she'd been a virgin when raped. All in all, she was what we would characterize as a low-risk victim taken from a low-risk setting. After being briefed, listening to Leary, and studying the files and crime scene photos, I jotted down the following half-page note. Profile. Sex, masculine. Race, white. Age, mid-20s, late-20s. Marital, married. Problems are divorced. Military, dishonorable, medical. Occupation, blue-collar, electrician, plumber. IQ, average, above average. Education, high school at most, dropout. Criminal record, arson, rape. Personality, confident, cocky, passed polygraph. Color vehicle, black or blue. Interrogate, direct, projection. This was the rape of opportunity, and the murder hadn't been planned or intended. The disheveled appearance of the clothing on the body indicated that Mary Frances had been forced to undress, then was allowed to redress hurriedly after the rape. I could see from the photos that one shoe was untied, and the report noted bleeding in her panties. No debris was on her back, behind, or feet, which suggested she was raped in a car, not on the wooded ground where her body was found. Looking intently at the rather routine crime scene photos, I began to understand what had happened. I could imagine the whole thing. Because of her youth, as well as her outgoing and trusting nature, Mary Frances would have been easily approachable in so non-threatening an environment as the school bus stop. The unsub probably coaxed her up to his car, then grabbed her or forced her in with a knife or gun. The remoteness of the area in which her body was found indicated that he knew the region well and knew he wouldn't be disturbed there. From the abduction scene, I could tell this wasn't a planned crime, but rather one that took form as he drove past. Just as in the Odom and Lawson case, had anyone else happened upon the scene at the right time, the crime wouldn't have gone forward. Because of the young girl's cuteness and sunny disposition, in his own mind, the fantasy-fueled offender had made over her innocent friendliness into promiscuity and the desire to play sexually with him. Of course, in actuality, nothing could have been further from the truth. Once he assaulted her, she would have been terrified, in severe pain, crying out for help and begging for her life. The fantasy he'd been nurturing for years was one thing, but the reality wasn't pretty. He'd lost control of the situation with this little girl and realized he was in one hell of a mess. At this point, he realizes the only way out for him is to kill her. But since she's in fear for her life, controlling her is much more difficult than he'd imagined. So to make it easier on himself, to make her more cooperative and compliant, he tells her to get dressed quickly, and he'll let her go. Either he'll let her run away, or maybe he'll tie her to a tree and leave the scene himself. But as soon as she turns her back on him, he comes up behind her and strangles her. He's probably able to render her unconscious, but strangulation requires a lot of upper body strength. He wasn't able to control her before, and he can't finish the job. He drags her under a tree, picks up the nearest large rock he can find, and drops it down on her head 3 or 4 times, killing her. I didn't feel the offender knew Mary Frances well, but they had seen each other around town enough for her to have recognized him and for him to have formed fantasies about her. He'd probably seen her going to school in her little majorette uniform. I knew from the placement of the coat over her head that our unsub didn't feel good about the crime. I also knew that time was against the police. In this type of crime and with this type of intelligent, organized offender, the longer he had to think about it, rationalize it, and justify it as the victim's fault, the more difficult it would be to get a confession. Even if he were polygraphed, the results would be inconclusive at best, and as soon as he felt the heat was off, and he wouldn't arouse suspicion by leaving, he'd be off to another part of the country where he'd be difficult to trace and where some other little girl would be in danger. To me, the unsub was clearly from the area, and the police had almost assuredly interviewed him already. He'd be cooperative but cocky, and if the police accused him, he wouldn't break. I told them a crime with this degree of sophistication would not be a first, although there was a good chance this was his first murder. His blue or black car would be several years old because he couldn't afford a newer one, but it would be functional and well-maintained. Everything in it would be in place. From my experience, orderly, compulsive people like that generally favored darker cars. After hearing all this, one of the officers on the phone said, "You just described a guy we released as a suspect in the case." He was still a suspect in another crime, and he fit the profile to a T. His name was Darryl Gene Devere, a white male, 24 years of age, who'd been married and divorced twice and who was currently living with his first ex-wife. He was a tree limb trimmer in Rome, Georgia, where he was a strong suspect in the rape of a 13-year-old girl, but had never been charged. He joined the army after his first divorce, but had gone AWOL and was discharged after 7 months. He drove a 3-year-old black Ford Pinto that was well maintained. He admitted to having been arrested as a juvenile for possession of a Molotov cocktail. He dropped out of school after 8th grade, but IQ tests listed a range of 100 to 110. He'd been interviewed to see if he had seen or heard anything since he'd been trimming trees on the Stoner Street for the power company for about 2 weeks before Mary Frances' abduction. The police told me he was scheduled for a polygraph that very day. That wouldn't be a good idea, I told them. They wouldn't get anything out of the exam, and it would only reinforce the suspect's ability to cope with the interrogation process. At that time, we didn't have a lot of field experience with interrogation, but from the prison interviews and the ongoing serial killer study, I felt that I knew what I was talking about. Sure enough, when they called me back the next day, they told me the lie detector had been inconclusive. Now that he knows he can beat the box, there's only one way to get him, I said. Stage the interrogation at the police station at night. The suspect will feel more comfortable initially, making him more vulnerable to questioning. This will also give him a message about your seriousness and dedication. He knows there isn't an arbitrary breakpoint like lunch or dinner, and he knows he's not going to be hung out as a media trophy if he caves in. Have the local police and the FBI's Atlanta field office carry out the interrogation together to show a united front and to imply that the full weight of the government of the United States is against him. Pile up stacks of file folders on tables in front of him with his name on them, even if they're just full of blank pages. Most important, without saying anything about it, place the bloody rock on a low table at a 45-degree angle to his line of sight, so that he'll have to turn his head to look at it. Closely observe all his nonverbal cues, his behavior, respiration, perspiration, carotid pulse. If he is the killer, he will not be able to ignore that rock, even though you haven't mentioned it or explained its significance. What we needed to create was what I call the high-ass pucker factor. I actually used the Stoner case as a laboratory for my theories. Many of the techniques we refined later had their experimental origins here. He won't confess, I continued. Georgia is a capital punishment state, and even if he's only sent to prison, his rap as a child molester could get his ass raped the first time he takes a shower. All of the other prisoners will be gunning for this guy. Use low, mysterious lighting, and have no more than two officers or agents in the interview environment at one time, preferably one from the FBI and one from the Adairsville PD. What you've got to do is imply that you understand the subject, understand what was going through his mind and the stresses he was under. No matter how disgusting it feels to you, you're going to have to project the blame onto the victim. Imply that she seduced him. Ask if she let him on, if she turned him on, if she threatened him with blackmail. Give him a face-saving scenario. Give him a way of explaining his actions. The other thing I knew from all the cases I'd seen is that in blunt force trauma or knife homicides, it's difficult for the attacker to avoid getting at least traces of the victim's blood on him. It's common enough that you can use it. When he starts to waffle, even slightly, I said, look him straight in the eye and tell him the most disturbing part of the whole case is the known fact that he got Mary's blood on him. We know you got blood on you, Gene. On your hands, on your clothing. The question for us isn't, did you do it? We know you did. The question is, why? We think we know why, and we understand. All you have to do is tell us if we're right. And that was exactly how it went down. They bring Devere in. He looks instantly at the rock, starts perspiring and breathing heavily. His body language is completely different from the previous interviews. Tentative, defensive. The interrogators project blame and responsibility onto the girl. And when he looks as if he's going with it, they bring up the blood. This really upsets him. You can often tell you've got the right guy if he shuts up and starts listening intently as you speak. An innocent guy will yell and scream. And even if a guilty guy yells and screams to make you think he's innocent, you can tell the difference. He admits to the rape and agrees with the interrogator that she threatened him. Bob Leary tells him they know he didn't plan on killing her. If he had, he would have used something more efficient than the rock. In the end, He confesses to the murder and to the rape in Rome the previous year. Daryl Gene Devere was tried for the rape and murder of Mary Frances Stoner, convicted, and sentenced to death. He was executed in the Georgia electric chair on May 18, 1995, almost 16 years after the murder and his arrest. That's almost 4 more years than Mary Frances had on Earth. The key to this type of interrogation, I found, is to be creative, to use your imagination. I had to ask myself, what would get to me if I were the one who did it? We're all vulnerable. It's going to be a different thing for each of us. In my case, with my sloppy bookkeeping, my SAC could probably call me in, have me see one of my expense vouchers on his desk, and make me sweat. But there's always something. Everybody has a rock. The lessons learned in the Devere case can have applications far beyond the sick world of sexual murder. Whether it's embezzlement, public corruption, a mob investigation, a fencing scheme, or a corrupt union you have to penetrate, it doesn't matter. The principles are going to be the same. What I would advise in any of these types of cases would be to target whomever you deem to be the weakest link. Figure out a way to bring him in and let him see what he's up against. Then win his cooperation in going after the others. In any kind of conspiracy case, this is a critical issue. What you want to do is flip one guy to be a government witness, then watch the whole house of cards come tumbling down. The choice of whom to approach first is so important because if you pick the wrong guy and then can't flip him, he's going to tip off everyone else and you're back at square one. Let's say we're investigating a big city public corruption case in which we suspect 8 or 10 people are involved from one particular agency. And let's say the number one or two man in the agency is the best catch. But when we profile the guy, we find that he has his personal act together despite the corruption. He isn't a boozer or a womanizer. In fact, he's a strong family man, no illnesses, no money problems, no obvious vulnerabilities. If he's approached by the FBI, there's a good chance he'd simply deny everything, tell us to go to hell, and alert the others. The way you get to someone like this is to go through the smaller fish, just as with organized crime. As we go through all the records, maybe one candidate will stand out from the rest for our purposes. He isn't a higher-up, but a clerk who fixes all the paperwork. He's been at his job for 20 years, so everything he has is invested in it. He has financial and medical problems, both of which provide strong vulnerabilities. Next comes the choice of who is cast to lead the interrogation. My preference is usually for someone a little older and more authoritative than the subject. A sharp dresser with a commanding appearance, someone who can be friendly and outgoing and make the subject relax, but become absolutely serious and directed as soon as circumstances call for it. If there's a holiday coming up in the next few weeks, or perhaps the subject's birthday or anniversary, I advise postponing the interrogation to take advantage of that. If you get him in the room and he realizes that if he doesn't cooperate, this might be the last holiday season he'll be spending with his family, that can give you some added leverage. Staging can be just as effective in dealing with a non-violent offender as it was in the Stoner murder case. For any large or ongoing investigation, I suggest concentrating all of your materials into one place, whether or not this was actually done for the case. For example, if you take over a conference room for your task force, gathering all your agents, staff, and case files together, you'll be showing your subject just how serious you are. If you can decorate the walls with, say, blow-ups of surveillance photos and other signs of just how wide-ranging and official this ongoing investigation is, the point will be driven home all the more forcefully. A couple of video monitors playing tapes of your targets in the act are icing on the cake. Among my personal favorite touches are wall charts showing the penalties each person would face if convicted. There's nothing terribly profound about this, but it does tend to keep the pressure on the subject and remind him of the stakes. I want to get that ass-pucker factor as intense as I can. I've always found that the late night or early morning hours are often the best time to conduct an interrogation. People tend to be more relaxed, and at the same time more vulnerable. Again, if you and your guys are working through the night, you immediately send the message that this case is a big deal, and you are very committed to it. Another practical consideration of a nighttime interrogation in any conspiracy case is that your subject should not be seen by any of the others. If he thinks he's been made, then there's not going to be any deal. The basis of any successful deal is going to be the truth and an appeal to your subject's reason and common sense. All the staging does is call attention to the key elements. If I were conducting the interrogation of our representative subject in the public corruption case, I might call him at home late at night and say something like, "Sir, it's very important that I talk to you tonight. FBI agents are walking up to your door even as we speak." I would stress that he wasn't under arrest and didn't have to go with the agents. But I'd strongly suggest that he accompany them downtown because he might not have another chance. There would be no need to Mirandize him at this point because he isn't being charged with anything. Once he arrived at the office, I'd let him cool his heels a while. When the other football team has to make a long yardage field goal on the last play to win the game, you call a timeout to give their kicker time to think about it. Anyone who's had to wait to see the doctor before an important appointment knows how effective this can be. Once he was ushered into my office, I'd close the door, trying to seem warm and friendly, very understanding, everything man to man. I'd call the guy by name. "I want to make sure you understand you're not under arrest," I'd reiterate. "You're free to leave anytime you want, and my men will drive you back home. But I think you should listen to what I have to say. This could be the most important date in your life." I might have him say the date with me to make sure we're on the same wavelength. "I also want you to know that we're aware of your medical history, and we have a nurse on standby." This would be true. One of the reasons we targeted this guy was because of this particular vulnerability. Now we start talking turkey. I would stress that the FBI realizes he's a little fish, that he's been underpaid for what he's done, and that he's not really the one we want the most. Right now, as you can see, we're interviewing many of the people involved in this case. The ship is going down, no question about it. You can go down with it, or you can reach up for the third time before drowning and grab for a life preserver. We know you've been used, manipulated, taken advantage of by others much more powerful than you. We have a U.S. attorney standing by to offer a real deal if you want to take it. As a parting shot, I would stress, remember, this is the only time we'll be able to make you this offer. I've got 20 agents working this case. We can go out and arrest everyone if we have to. Don't you think someone will roll if you don't? And then you'll go down with the ship. If you want to go down with the big guys, that's your choice. But tonight is the last time we'll be able to talk like this. Will you cooperate? If he does, and it really is in his best interests, if he does, then we Mirandize him and let him contact an attorney. But as a good faith gesture, I'd probably ask him to get on the phone and arrange a meeting with one of the other players. You don't want him having second thoughts and backing out. Once you've got your first guy's commitment, the rest of the pieces start falling into place. The reason this works so effectively, even if you understand our complete approach in advance, is because it's mutually beneficial to the investigator and the targeted subject. It's based on truth and tailored to the subject's life and situation and emotional needs. Even knowing how it was staged for maximum impact, if I were the subject presented with this deal, I'd take it, because it does represent my best chance. The strategy behind this type of interrogation is the same as the one I developed for the Stoner murder case. I keep thinking to myself, what would get to me? Because everybody has a rock. Gary Trapnell, the armed robber and airplane hijacker I interviewed at the federal prison in Marion, Illinois, is just about as intelligent and insightful as any criminal I've studied. He's the one who was so confident in his own abilities that he assured me he could fool any prison psychiatrist into believing he had any given mental condition I specified. He was also confident that if he were out of prison, he'd be able to evade the law. "You just can't catch me," he asserted. "Okay, Gary," I said hypothetically, "you're out, and you're smart enough to know you have to break off all contact with family members to keep away from the feds. Now, I know your father was a high-ranking, decorated military officer. You really loved and respected him. You wanted to be like him. And your crime spree began when he died." I could see from his facial reaction that I was onto something, that I'd hit a nerve. "Your dad is buried in Arlington National Cemetery. So suppose I have agents staking out his grave around Christmas, on his birthday, and the anniversary of the date he died." In spite of himself, Trapnell broke out into a sardonic smile. "You got me," he announced. Again, the reason this occurred to me was because I tried to put myself in his place. I tried to figure out what would get to me. And my experience tells me that there is a way to get to everyone, if you can only figure out what it is. In my own case, it might be something similar to what I would have used on Trapnell. That is, a particular date might be the emotional trigger. My sister Arlene had a beautiful blonde daughter named Kim. She was born on my birthday, June 18th, and I always felt a special bond with her. When she was 16, Kim died in her sleep. We were never able to find out the exact cause. To compound the pain and joy of her memory, it happens that my eldest daughter, Erica, now college age, looks very much like Kim. I'm sure that Arlene never sees Erica without seeing Kim in her mind, picturing what Kim would have grown up to become. My mother feels the same way. If I were to target me, for instance, I'd plan the approach right before my birthday. I'm emotionally up, looking forward to the celebration with my family, but I'm also thinking about my niece, Kim, the birthday we shared, how much she resembles Erica. And I'm going to be feeling vulnerable. If I happen to see photographs of the two girls on the wall, I'm likely to come even more unglued. It doesn't matter that I know what the overall strategy is in approaching me. It doesn't matter that I'm the one who came up with it. If the triggering stressor is a legitimate, valid concern, it will have a good chance of working. This one could be mine. Yours would be something else, and we'd have to figure out in advance what it would be. But there would be something, because everybody has a rock.
This ends side one of cassette six. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.
Chapter 11. Atlanta. In the winter of 1981, Atlanta was a city under siege. It had begun quietly a year and a half earlier, almost unnoticed. Before it was over, if in fact it will ever be over, it had become one of the largest and perhaps one of the most publicized manhunts in American history, politicizing a town and polarizing a nation, every step of the investigation steeped in bitter controversy. On July 28, 1979, police responded to a complaint of a foul odor in the woods off Nisky Lake Road and discovered the body of 13-year-old Alfred Evans. He'd been missing for 3 days. While examining the site, police discovered another body about 50 feet away, this one partially decomposed, belonging to 14-year-old Edward Smith, who disappeared 4 days before Alfred. Both boys were black. The medical examiner determined that Alfred Evans had probably been strangled, while Edward Smith had definitely been shot with a .22 caliber weapon. On November 8th, the body of 9-year-old Yusuf Bell was discovered in an abandoned school. He'd been missing since late October and had also been strangled. 8 days later, 14-year-old Milton Harvey's body was found near Red Wine Road and Desert Drive in the East Point section of Atlanta. He'd been reported missing in early September, and as with Alfred Evans, no definite cause of death could be determined. Both of these children were also black. But there wasn't enough similar evidence to attach any particular significance. Unfortunately, in a city the size of Atlanta, children disappear all the time. Some of them are found dead. On the morning of March 5th, 1980, a 12-year-old girl named Angel Lanier set out for school but never arrived. 5 days later, her body was found, bound and gagged with an electrical cord on the side of a road. She was fully clothed, including her underwear, but another pair of panties had been stuffed in her mouth. Cause of death was determined to be ligature strangulation. The medical examiner found no evidence of sexual assault. 11-year-old Jeffrey Mathis disappeared on March 12th. At this point, the Atlanta Police Department still hadn't made anything out of 6 black children either missing or turning up dead. There were as many differences as similarities among the cases, and they hadn't seriously considered the possibility that some or all of them might be related. But other people had. On April 15th, Yusuf Bell's mother, Camille, aligned with other parents of missing and slain black children and announced the formation of the Committee to Stop Children's Murders. They pleaded for official help and recognition of what they saw going on around them. This wasn't supposed to be happening in Atlanta, the cosmopolitan capital of the New South. This was a city on the move, the town supposedly too busy to hate, which boasted a black mayor in Maynard Jackson and a black public safety commissioner in Lee Brown. The horrors didn't stop. On May 19th, 14-year-old Eric Middlebrook was found murdered about a quarter mile from his home. Death was caused by blunt force trauma to the head. On June 9th, 12-year-old Christopher Richardson disappeared. And on June 22nd, the second young girl, 8-year-old LaTonya Wilson, was abducted from her bedroom in the early hours of a Sunday morning. 2 days later, 10-year-old Aaron Weish's body was found beneath a bridge in DeKalb County. He died of asphyxia and a broken neck. Anthony Tony Carter, 9, was found behind a warehouse on Wells Street on July 6th, face down in the grass, dead of multiple stab wounds. From the absence of blood at the scene, it was clear his body had been moved from another location. The pattern could no longer be ignored. Public Safety Commissioner Brown set up the Missing and Murdered Task Force, which would ultimately include more than 50 members. Yet on it went. Earl Terrell, 10, was reported missing on July 31st, off Red Wine Road, near where Milton Harvey's body had been found. And when 12-year-old Clifford Jones was found dead by ligature strangulation in an alley off Hollywood Road, the police finally accepted a connection and stated that the investigation would now be conducted under the assumption that the murders of black children were related. Up until this point, the FBI had no jurisdiction to enter a case that, for all its hideous enormity, remained a series of local crimes. A break came with Earl Terrell's disappearance. His family had received several telephone calls demanding a ransom for the safe return of their son. The caller indicated that Earl had been taken to Alabama. The presumed crossing of state lines brought the federal kidnapping statute into effect and allowed the FBI to investigate. But it soon became clear that the ransom calls had been a hoax. Hopes faded for Earl's life, and the FBI had to back out. Another boy, 11-year-old Darren Glass, was reported missing on September 16th. Mayor Maynard Jackson asked the White House for help, specifically to have the FBI conduct a major investigation into the Atlanta child murders and disappearances. With jurisdiction still very much an issue, Attorney General Griffin Bell ordered the FBI to begin an investigation of whether the children who had not been found were being held in violation of the federal kidnapping statute. In other words, was there an interstate character to the crimes? As an added responsibility, the Atlanta field office was charged with determining if the cases were in fact linked. In effect, but not in so many words, the Bureau was given the message, solve the cases and find the killer as quickly as possible. The media, of course, had seized on the frenzy. The growing gallery of young black faces published regularly in the newspapers became a proclamation of collective municipal guilt. Was this a conspiracy to commit genocide on the black population, targeting its most vulnerable members? Was this the Klan or Nazi Party or some other hate group set to make its stand a decade and a half after the major civil rights legislation? Was this simply one crazed individual with a personal mission to kill young children? This last possibility seemed the least likely. These kids were falling victim at an incredibly rapid rate. And while to date, the overwhelming majority of serial killers had been white, almost never did they hunt outside their own race. Serial murder is a personal crime, not a political one. But this did give the FBI another possible legitimacy in the case. If the interstate kidnapping angle didn't pan out, we were still charged with determining if this fit the 44 classification, violation of federal civil rights. By the time Roy Hazelwood and I went down to Atlanta, there were 16 cases with no end in sight. By then, the Bureau's involvement had an official case name, AtKid. Also designated Major Case 30, though there was little public fanfare when the FBI came in. The Atlanta police didn't want anyone stealing their show, and the FBI's Atlanta field office didn't want to create expectations they might not be able to meet. Roy Hazelwood was the logical choice to join me in Atlanta. Of all the behavioral science unit instructors, Roy was doing the most profiling, teaching the National Academy course on interpersonal violence, and taking on many of the rape cases that came to the unit. Our primary goals were to determine for ourselves if the cases were linked, and if so, was there a conspiracy? We reviewed the voluminous case files, crime scene photos, descriptions of what each child was wearing when found, statements from witnesses in the area, autopsy protocols. We interviewed family members of the children to see if there was a common victimology. The police drove us around the neighborhoods where the children had disappeared and took us to each of the body dump sites. Without talking over our impressions with each other, Roy and I both took psychometric tests administered by a forensic psychologist, which we filled out as if each of us were the killer. The test involved motivation, background, and family life. The types of things we'd put into a profile. The doctor who administered the test was amazed that our results were nearly identical. And what we had to say wasn't aimed at winning any popularity contests. First, we didn't think these were Klan-type hate crimes. Second, we were almost positive the offender was black. And third, while many of the deaths and disappearances were related, not all of them were. The Georgia Bureau of Investigation had received several tips about Ku Klux Klan involvement, but we discounted them. If you study hate crimes going all the way back to the early days of the nation, you find that they tend to be highly public, highly symbolic acts. A lynching is intended to make a public statement and create a public display. Such a crime or other racial murder is an act of terrorism. and for it to have an effect, it must be highly visible. Ku Klux Klansmen don't wear white sheets to fade into the woodwork. If a hate group had targeted black children throughout the Atlanta area, it wouldn't have been content to let months go by before the police and the public figured out something was going on. We would have expected bodies strung up on Main Street, USA, and the message would have been none too subtle. We didn't see any of that type of behavior in these cases. The body dump sites were in predominantly or exclusively black areas of the city. A white individual, much less a white group, could not have prowled these neighborhoods without being noticed. The police had canvassed extensively and had no reports of whites near any of the children or dump sites. These areas had street activity around the clock, so even under the cover of night, a white man couldn't have been around there completely unnoticed. This also fit in with our experience that sexual killers tend to target their own race, even though there was no clear evidence of sexual molestation. These crimes definitely fit a sexual pattern. There was a strong link among many of the victims. They were young and outgoing and streetwise, but inexperienced and rather naive about the world beyond their neighborhood. We felt this was the type of child who would be susceptible to a come-on or ruse or con from the right individual. That individual would have to have a car, since the children were taken away from the abduction sites. And we felt he would have to have some aura of adult authority. Many of these kids lived in conditions of obvious poverty. In some of the houses, we found no electricity or running water. Because of that and the children's relative lack of sophistication, I didn't think it would take much of a lure. To test this, we had Atlanta undercover officers go into these areas, often posing as workmen, and offer a child $5 to come with him to do some job. They tried it with black officers and with white officers, and it didn't seem to matter. These kids were so desperate for survival, they'd do just about anything for $5. It wasn't going to take someone all that sharp to get to them. The one other thing the experiment showed was that white men were noticed in these neighborhoods. But as I said, while we did find a strong linkage, it didn't seem to apply to all the cases. After carefully evaluating the victims and the circumstances, I didn't think the two girls had been killed by the primary offender, or even by the same person as each other. The manner of LaTonya Wilson's abduction from her bedroom was too specialized. Of the boys, I thought most of the soft kills, the strangulations, were related, not necessarily all the unknown causes of death. And other aspects of the evidence led us to believe we weren't dealing with a single killer. Strong evidence in a couple of the cases suggested the killer had been a member of the victim's family. But when FBI Director William Webster announced this publicly, he was slam-dunked by the press. Aside from the obvious political problems with such a statement, any case separated from the missing and murdered list made that family ineligible to receive any of the funds that were starting to be contributed by groups and individuals around the country. Even though we felt more than one person was responsible, we felt we were dealing with one particular individual who was on a tear, and he would keep killing until he was found. Roy and I profiled a black male, single, between the ages of 25 and 29. He would be a police buff, drive a police-type vehicle, and somewhere along the way he would insinuate himself into the investigation. He would have a police-type dog, either a German Shepherd or a Doberman. He would not have a girlfriend. He would be sexually attracted to the young boys. But we weren't seeing any signs of rape or other overt sexual abuse. This, I thought, spoke to his sexual inadequacy. He would have some kind of ruse or con with these kids. I was betting on something having to do with music or performing. He would have a good line, but he couldn't produce. At some point early in the relationship, the kid would reject him, or he would at least perceive it that way, and he would feel compelled to kill. Atlanta PD checked all known pedophiles and sexual priors, eventually getting down to a list of about 1,500 possible suspects. Police officers and FBI agents visited schools, interviewing children to see if any of them had been approached by adult males and hadn't told their parents or the police. And they rode buses, passing out flyers with the missing children's photos, asking if anybody had seen them, particularly in the company of men. They had undercover officers hanging out at gay bars, trying to overhear conversations and pick up leads. Not everyone agreed with us, and not everyone was happy to have us down there. At one of the crime scenes in an abandoned apartment house, one black cop came up to me and said, "You're Douglas, aren't you?" "Yeah, that's right." "I saw your profile. It's a piece of shit." I wasn't sure whether he was actually evaluating my work or pointing up the newspaper's frequent claim that there were no black serial killers. This wasn't exactly true. We had had cases of black serial killers of both prostitutes and members of their own families, but not much in the way of strange murders, and none with the modus operandi we were seeing here. "Look, I don't have to be here," I said. "I didn't ask to come." At any rate, the frustration level was high. Everyone involved wanted the case solved, but everyone wanted to crack it himself. As was often true, Roy and I knew we were down there to take some of the flack and be blamed if everything hit the fan. Aside from the Klan conspiracy scenario, all kinds of theories were floating around, some more bizarre than others. Various children were found missing various articles of clothing, but none identical. Was this killer outfitting his own mannequin at home the way Ed Gein had tried collecting sections of women's skin? On the later kills, was the unsub evolving by leaving bodies more out in the open? Or was it possible the original unsub had committed suicide and a copycat had taken over for him? To me, the first real break came when I was back in Quantico. A call had come into the police department in Conyers, a small town about 20 miles from Atlanta. They thought they might finally have a lead. I listened to the tape in Larry Monroe's office, along with Dr. Park Dietz. Before becoming Behavioral Science Unit Chief, Monroe had been one of the outstanding instructors at Quantico. Like Ann Burgess, Park Dietz had been brought to the unit by Roy Hazelwood. He was at Harvard at the time and just starting to get a reputation in law enforcement circles. Now based in California, Park's probably the foremost forensic psychiatrist in the country, and a frequent consultant to our unit. The caller on the tape professed to be the Atlanta child killer, and mentioned the name of the most recent known victim. He was obviously white, sounded like a typical redneck, and promised he was going to kill more of these nigger kids. He also named a particular spot along Sigmund Road in Rockdale County where police could find another body. I remember the excitement in the room, which I'm afraid I squelched. "This is not the killer," I declared. "But you have to catch him because he'll keep calling and be a pain in the ass and a distracting force as long as he's out there." Despite the police excitement, I felt confident I was right about this jerk. I'd had a similar situation shortly before this when Bob Ressler and I had been over in England to teach a course at Bramshill, the British Police Academy, and their equivalent to Quantico, about an hour outside London. England was in the midst of the Yorkshire Ripper murders. The killer, who apparently patterned himself after the Whitechapel murderer of late Victorian times, was bludgeoning and stabbing women up north, mostly prostitutes. There'd been 8 deaths so far. 3 more women had managed to escape, but could provide no description. The age range estimates ran from early teens to late 50s. Like Atlanta, all of England was gripped in terror. It was the largest manhunt in British history. The police would ultimately conduct nearly 250,000 individual interviews throughout the country. Police departments and newspapers had received letters from Jack the Ripper, confessing to the crimes. Then a 2-minute tape cassette arrived in the mail to Chief Inspector George Oldfield, taunting the police and promising to strike again. As in the Atlanta case, this seemed to be the big breakthrough. The tape was copied and played throughout the country, on television and radio, on toll-free telephone lines, over the PA at soccer matches, to see if anyone could recognize the voice. We'd been told that John DeMille was at Bram's Hill while we were there. He's a big-shot cop and the lead investigator on the Ripper cases. He's told that these two profiling guys from the FBI are here and maybe we should get together. So after class, Bob and I are sitting alone in the Academy pub when this guy comes in, is recognized by someone at the bar, and goes over and starts talking to him. We can read his non-verbals and know he's making fun of the blokes from the U.S. I say to Ressler, "I bet that's him." Sure enough, we're pointed out to him. He and the other guys come over to our table, and he introduces himself. I say, "I noticed you didn't bring any files with you." He starts making excuses about how complicated a case this is, and it would be difficult to bring us up to speed in a short amount of time and such like that. "Fine," I reply. "We've got plenty of cases of our own. I just as soon sit here and drink." This take-it-or-leave-it approach gets the Brits interested. One of them asks what we would need to profile a case. I tell him to start by just describing the scenes. He tells me that the unsub seems to get the women in a vulnerable position and then blitzes them with a knife or hammer. He mutilates them after death. The voice on the tape was pretty articulate and sophisticated for a prostitute killer. So I say, "Based on the crime scenes you've described and this audio tape I heard back in the States, that's not the Ripper. You're wasting your time with that." I explained that the killer he was looking for would not communicate with the police. He'd be an almost invisible loner in his late 20s or early 30s with a pathological hatred of women, a school dropout, and possibly a truck driver, since he seemed to get around quite a bit. His killing of prostitutes was his attempt to punish women in general. Despite the fortune of time and resources they'd spent on getting this tape out, DeMille said, "You know, I was worried about that," and later changed the course of his investigation. When 35-year-old truck driver Peter Sutcliffe was arrested on a fluke on January 2, 1981, in the midst of the Atlanta horrors, and was proved to be the Ripper, he bore little resemblance to the one who had made and sent the tape. The imposter turned out to be a retired policeman who had a grudge to settle with Inspector Oldfield. After listening to the Georgia tape, I spoke to the Conyers and Atlanta police, and off the top of my head came up with a scenario I thought would take out this imposter. Like the Rippers, this guy's voice was taunting and superior. "From the tone of his voice and what he's saying, he thinks you're all dumb shit," I said. "So let's use this." I advised them to play as dumb as he thought they were. Go to Sigmund Road, but search the opposite side of the street. Miss him completely. He'll be watching, and maybe you'll get lucky and grab him right there. If not, he'll at least call and tell you what idiots you are, that you're looking in the wrong place. Park Dietz loves this, assimilating this off-the-cuff field stuff into his academic knowledge. The police make a very public show of looking for this body, screw up the directions, and sure enough, the guy calls back to tell them how stupid they are. They're ready with the trap and trace and get this older redneck right in his house. Just to make sure he's not on the level, they search the right area of Sigmund Road, but of course, there's no body. The Conyers incident wasn't the only red herring in this case. Large investigations often have a fair number of them, and Atlanta was no exception. Close to the road, in the woods near where the earliest skeletonized remains were found, detectives discovered a girly magazine with semen on some of the pages. The FBI lab was able to lift latent fingerprints and from that get an ID. It's a white male who drives a van, and he's an exterminator. The psychological symbolism, of course, is perfect. For this type of sociopath, it's only one small step from exterminating bugs to exterminating black children. we already know that many serial killers return to crime scenes and dump sites. The police speculate that he pulls along the side of the road in his car, looks out over his conquest, and masturbates as he recalls the thrill of the hunt and kill. This development works its way up to the director of the FBI, to the Attorney General, all the way to the White House. All of them are anxiously waiting to make the announcement that they've got the Atlanta child killer. A press release is being prepared. But a couple of things bother me. For one thing, he's white. For another, he's happily married. I figure there must be another reason why this guy was there. They bring him in for questioning. He denies everything. They show him the magazine with semen stuck to the pages. They tell him they've got his prints on it. Okay, he admits, I was driving along and I threw it out of the car. This doesn't make any sense either. He's driving along, one hand on the wheel, the other hand on himself, and he manages to throw this thing out of a car so that it lands in the woods. He'd have to have an arm like Johnny Unitas. Realizing this is a serious jam he's in, he admits that his wife is pregnant, due any day, and he hasn't had sex in months. Rather than even think of cheating on this woman he loves, who's about to bear his child, he went down to the 7-Eleven, bought this magazine, then thought he'd go out into these isolated woods on his lunch hour and gain some relief. My heart went out to this guy. Nothing is sacred. He figures he'll go off where he won't bother anybody, mind his own business, and now even the President of the United States knows he was jacking off in the woods. When they caught the imposter in Conyers, I thought that would be that. At least we'd be able to get this racist ass out of the way so the police could concentrate on their investigation. But I hadn't factored one thing in properly, and that was the active role of the press. Since then, I've made sure never to commit that oversight again. One thing I had realized was that, at a certain point, the vast media attention the child murders were getting became a satisfaction to the killer in its own right. What I hadn't counted on was that he would be reacting specifically to media reports. What happened was, the press was so hungry for any possible break in the case that they heavily covered the police search along Sigmund Road, which came up empty. But soon afterward, another body is found in open view along Sigmund Road in Rockdale County, that of 15-year-old Terry Pugh. To me, this is an incredibly significant development and the beginning of the strategy for how to catch the killer. What it means is, he's closely following the press and reacting to what they're reporting. He knows the police aren't going to find a body on Sigmund Road because he didn't put one there. But now he's showing how superior he is, how he can manipulate the press and the police. He's showing his arrogance and contempt. He can dump a body along Sigmund Road if he wants to. He's broken his pattern and driven 20 or 30 miles just to play this game. We know he's watching, so let's see if we can use that to manipulate his behavior. Had I known this, or considered the possibility beforehand, I would have thought about staking out the general area along Sigmund Road. But it was too late for that now. We had to look forward and see what we could do. I had several ideas. Frank Sinatra and Sammy Davis Jr. were coming to Atlanta to give a benefit concert at the Omni to raise money for families of the victims. The event was receiving tremendous coverage, and I was absolutely certain the killer would be there. The challenge was how to pick him out of 20-odd thousand people. Roy Hazelwood and I had profiled a police buff. That could be the key. "Let's give him a free ticket," I suggested. As usual, the police and Atlanta field office agents looked at me as if I were crazy. So I explained, "We'll advertise that because so many people are expected, additional security guards will be needed. We'll offer minimum wage, require that each applicant must have his own vehicle, since we knew our guy had one, and those with some kind of background or experience with law enforcement will be given preference. We have the screening interviews at the Omni using hidden, closed-circuit television. We'll eliminate the groups we don't care about, women, older people, etc., and concentrate mainly on young black men. Each one will fill out an application on which we'll have them list experience such as ambulance driving, whether they've ever applied for a police or security job before, all the things that will help us qualify our suspect. We can probably get down to a group of maybe 10 or 12 individuals that we can then cross-check against the other evidence. This idea went right up the line to the Assistant Attorney General. The problem is, any time you have a large organization working on anything that isn't right out of the book, analysis paralysis can set in. By the time my strategy was finally approved, it was the day before the concert, and the feeble attempt to recruit security guards at that point was too little, too late. I had another scheme. I wanted to have wooden crosses made up about a foot high. Some would be given to families, others would be placed at crime scenes as memorials. One large one could be erected at a church in collective memory of the children. Once this was publicized, I knew the killer would visit some of the sites, particularly the remote ones. He might even try to take one of the crosses. If we had key sites surveilled, I thought we'd have a good chance of nabbing him. But it took the Bureau weeks to okay the plan. Then there was a turf war over who got to make the crosses. Should it be the FBI exhibit section in Washington, the carpentry shop at Quantico, or should the Atlanta field office contract it out? The crosses did eventually get made, but by the time they were usable, events in the case had overtaken us. By February, the city was about out of control. Psychics were swarming around, all giving their own profiles, many dramatically contradicting each other. The press was jumping on any possibility, quoting anyone remotely related to the case who would talk. The next victim to turn up after Terry Pugh's body was found along Sigmund Road was 12-year-old Patrick Baltazar, off Buford Highway in DeKalb County. Like Terry Pugh, he'd been strangled. At that time, someone in the medical examiner's office announced that hair and fibers found on Patrick Baltazar's body matched those found on five of the previous victims. These were among the ones I'd linked together as having the same killer. The announcement of the forensic findings received wide-scale coverage. And something clicked with me. He's going to start dumping bodies in the river. Now he knows they're getting hair and fiber. One previous body, that of Patrick Rogers, had been found on the Cobb County side of the Chattahoochee River in December, a victim of blunt force trauma to the head. But Patrick was 15, 5'9", and 145 pounds, a school dropout who'd been in trouble with the law. The police weren't considering his case related. Whether he was or not, though, I felt the killer would come to the river now, where the water would wash away any trace evidence. "We've got to start surveilling the rivers," I said, "particularly the Chattahoochee, the major waterway that forms the northwestern boundary of the city with neighboring Cobb County." But several police jurisdictions were involved, one for each county, as well as the FBI, and no one could take overall charge. By the time a joint surveillance operation composed of FBI and Homicide Task Force personnel was organized and approved, it was already into April. But in the meantime, I wasn't surprised when the next body found, 13-year-old Curtis Walker, showed up in the South River. The next two, Timmy Hill, 13, and Eddie Duncan, the oldest at 21, appeared within a day of each other in the Chattahoochee. Unlike the previous victims, most of whom had been found fully clothed, these three bodies had been stripped to their underwear, another way of removing hair and fiber. Weeks went by with the surveillance teams in place, watching bridges and potential dump sites along the river. But nothing was happening. It was clear the authorities were losing faith and felt as if they were getting nowhere. With no clear progress being made, the operation was scheduled to be shut down at the 6 a.m. shift change on May 22nd. At about 2:30 that very morning, a police academy recruit named Bob Campbell was on his final surveillance shift on the bank of the Chattahoochee beneath the Jackson Parkway Bridge. He saw a car drive across and apparently stop briefly in the middle. "I just heard a loud splash," he reported tensely into his walkie-talkie. He directed his flashlight into the water and saw the ripples. The car turned around and came back across the bridge, where a stakeout car followed it and then pulled it over. It was a 1970 Chevy station wagon, and the driver was a short, curly-haired, 23-year-old, very light black man named Wayne Bertram Williams. He was cordial and cooperative. He claimed to be a music promoter and said he lived with his parents. Police questioned him and looked into his car before letting him go, but they didn't lose track of him. 2 days later, the nude body of 27-year-old Nathaniel Cater surfaced downstream, not far from where the body of Jimmy Ray Payne, 21, had been found a month earlier. There wasn't enough evidence to arrest Williams and get a search warrant, but he was put under bumper lock surveillance. He soon became aware of the police following him and led them on wild goose chases throughout the city. He even drove to Safety Commissioner Lee Brown's home and started honking his horn. He had a dark room in his house, and before a warrant could be obtained, he was observed burning photographs in his backyard. He also washed out the car. Wayne Williams fit our profile in every key respect, including his ownership of a German Shepherd. He was a police buff who'd been arrested some years earlier for impersonating a law officer. After that, he'd driven a surplus police vehicle and used police scanners to get to crime scenes to take pictures. In retrospect, several witnesses recalled seeing him along Sigmund Road when the police were reacting to the phone tip and searching for the non-existent body. He'd been taking photographs there, which he offered to the police. We also found out that he had indeed attended the benefit concert at the Omni. Without arresting him, the FBI asked him to come to the office, where he was cooperative, and didn't ask for an attorney. From reports I received, I didn't feel that the interrogation had been properly planned or organized. It had been too heavy-handed and direct, and I thought he was reachable at that point. After the interview, I was told he hung around the office and acted as if he still wanted to talk about police and FBI stuff. But when he left that day, I knew they would never get a confession out of him. He agreed to a polygraph, which proved inconclusive. Later, when police and FBI agents got a warrant and searched the house he shared with his retired schoolteacher parents, they found books that showed how to beat a lie detector. That warrant was obtained on June 3rd. Despite Williams's having washed out the car, police found hair and fiber linking him with about 12 of the murders, the exact ones I had profiled as being done by the same killer. The evidence was compelling. Not only did they get fibers linking the bodies to Williams's room and house and car, Larry Peterson of the Georgia State Crime Lab matched fibers from clothing some of the victims had worn on occasions prior to their disappearance. In other words, there was a connection to Williams before some of the murders.
This ends Side 2 of Cassette 6 of Mindhunter. Please fast forward to the end before loading Cassette 7.